Everyone has some sort of a closet that has become too small. A closet is no place to live, and I want to support as many people as I can in stepping out of that prison into the fullness of life that is waiting for them on the other side of that door. This is Nancy Shadlock from Centered Life Coaching. Join me in listening to these coming out chronicles. Get curious about their stories. And then go see what good things are waiting for you on the other side of your closet door.
Hi, it's me, Nancy Shadlock. I bet you were wondering if you were ever going to hear from me again after I put out my last podcast in November entitled Quitting. And you probably wondered if I was ever coming back. Well, I'm here for a little bit longer. Who knows how much longer? I would love to hear from you if you love this podcast and you want it not to die anytime soon. Reach out and let me know. I'm looking for a successor. Keep it going because I don't know if I have it in me, but I do have some amazing podcasts that I recorded a while back that I still want to share with you. I did think very deeply about quitting and I almost did, but I've decided to make a bit of a pivot and move into more working in organizations. And I've created a game called the Magic Tickle Trunk that helps people step into someone else's shoes for a little bit. You might remember Mr. Dress Up, a Canadian classic TV show that I watched as a kid, and you might have too, where he has this tickle trunk where you can try on clothes. And so it's a way of going into an organization and helping them grow in diversity, equity, and inclusion in ways that are kind of fun. And I think you've probably heard the Plato quote that says you can learn more about a person from an hour of play than a year of conversation. And I think that's really true. When we can jump in and play with each other, we go to these deeper levels. And then the debrief that happens at the end of this experience is powerful. I've seen it happen over and over again now where people really realize something about their privilege or about their own disabilities and how they can understand someone else who might be different than them because of that. And it grows this layer of empathy in such a strong way that helps people really want to show up at work and be their true selves and be known and stick around because it's a beautiful place. So that's kind of my focus in the next year here is to really zero in on organizations, boards, companies, places where they're really wanting to grow in inclusiveness and connection, not just so they can tick a box on their roster, but so that they can really grow deeply and be connected. If you'd like to hear more about the Magic Tickle Trunk role-playing experience, you can email me at nancy@centered.ca. I look forward to hearing from you. And without further ado, here is one of my favorite interviews with someone who I got to meet recently in person in Berlin. Nadia is a mentor of mine. She's been teaching me a lot about how to help people in leadership to learn about themselves and to grow as conscious leaders so that when things trigger them, they don't just lash out, but so that they can be aware of them and notice what's going on. The other thing I love about this conversation is that Nadia shares about her own deeply held homophobia, and that even though she's been married to a woman for years, she still feels that. And I love that we're not alone in those feelings and that everyone has to look at those kinds of things within themselves and grow. And she shares some really cool tools that she uses in her own life to help herself grow and move through things that block her. So enjoy.
So jump right in. Tell us what coming out story you want to share.
Hmm.
Well, let's see. So for me, the whole coming out process was a rather interesting and or challenging experience in my life, but in a slightly different way from other coming out stories, the way I've experienced them through friends and clients. Because in my particular case, I fell in love for the first time knowingly with a woman when I was 28. And this woman I'm now married to, her name is Olga. But I had never been in love with a woman before, and I did not have one of those, you know, coming to Jesus moments that some of my friends had, where when they kissed a woman for the first time, they were suddenly, ta-da, you know, I've been gay all my life and I just had no idea, and this is what it's supposed to feel like. You know, and honestly, it wasn't like that. It was, I was very much in love, and at the same time, it was awkward, and it didn't feel completely right. It was uncomfortable and exciting, you know, and all of these things mixed into one. But it wasn't an awakening. It was a very uncomfortable coming to terms with that I had fallen in love with a person of the same sex, and I had no idea what to do with that in my life. That was sort of our beginning.
Right. Had you fallen in love with men before?
Yeah. So, you know, as far as I knew, I was straight, and I was, you know, sort of actively waiting for my prince on the white horse when Olga rode into my life, and she wasn't at all what I thought I had ordered. But, you know, at our wedding, I sort of joked that I, you know, had this romantic longing for my soulmate, and I should have maybe been a bit more specific. You know, I definitely got my soulmate. I think that's what has kept us together all of these years. And it wasn't what I thought it would be. Yeah, so I think that was one of the big aha moments in my life, is that sometimes what you need may take a very different form than what you wanted it or expected it to be.
Mm-hmm. I think that's most things.
Yes, probably. But yeah. That was a very vivid experience for me, I would say, in that particular life lesson.
Mm-hmm. So you were friends, like what was the context for getting to know her?
Actually, our context expands very much into our earlier years. So Olga and I have known each other since we were 16. Olga is Polish, came to Germany when she was 5, and the state that she ended up living in Germany was the state of Hesse, and that was the same state in which I grew up. And we are pretty much exactly the same age. And when we were in, let me think, 10th grade, there was a statewide competition for the arts. So they invited students from all different schools in that state to participate in doing artwork, and that could be, you know, writing, making music, drawing, painting, really anything. And then they reviewed whatever you had sent in, and Olga was among the poets, and I was among those who had sent in a very large drawing. Mm-hmm. And then they selected 20 kids or 20 students for each of the categories. And it was actually a lovely program, because what they then did is take us away for a whole weekend with grown-up artists. So that was our, you know, we didn't get prize money. That was our prize, if you want. And during one of those artistic retreats, that's where I met Olga. So we were both 16, and I was completely mesmerized by her. She was so different from me. I was such a good girl, right? So I had always done everything as was expected from me. And Olga was such a rebel by heart, and she smoked, and she was cynical and extremely educated, and was really reading all of these, you know, heavy Russian literature. And I just thought she was the coolest thing since sliced bread. So I would definitely say I had a huge crush on her, and vice versa. She actually, the way she remembers it is that she says she tried to kiss me, but I wouldn't have it. I don't completely remember that, but I do remember that I was a little overwhelmed with her, you know, she was just a lot more experienced also sexually than me at the time. So I felt intimidated, I would say, to some degree by her.
Did she know she was gay already at that point?
Yeah, she did. So Olga is, you know, she always jokes that she's a gold star lesbian. Like she knew when she was five, she fell in love with Princess Leia in Star Wars. And that was, you know, the end of that. Her heart was lost forever to men or for men. And yeah, so, you know, very different trajectory that our lives took in many different areas, not just that particular topic, but Olga also sort of based on her psychic structure and her particular family struggles, she actually left school very early and went to Berlin when she was 17. So shortly after she and I got to know each other. And I stayed on the expected path and finished high school and went to university and did all of those things, right? So there was this great convergence of our lives when we were 16. There was a very intense friendship for about a year. Then I went to the States as an exchange student. And during that year of me being, you know, of all places in Iowa City, and that was pre-email and pre-affordable phone calls, pre-internet, it was difficult to stay in touch. However, we still have letters from that time. And when I read those letters today, I can definitely say that I had a crush on her, but I also had no idea what to do with these feelings that I had for her, right? So I sort of pushed all of that back into a box, put it under the bed. And then we had lost contact for years until I was 28 and my cousin moved to Berlin. And I remembered somebody had told me that Olga was in Berlin and I contacted her. And, you know, again, initially we were just friends, but then after a year of friendship, I realized that I had some deeper feelings for her. And that's what then kickstarted this whole new branch of my life.
Yeah. So then what did that look like when you started to realize you had feelings?
Oh, it was confusing. You know, you remember maybe the times well, actually you might not because you're younger than me, but during those times when you had a phone and when somebody would call you, your line was either free or busy. That was sort of the two states of being, right? And I realized that I tried to keep my line free in case Olga would call me, right? Yeah. And then at some point, I was living with one of my best friends in Berlin, and I was telling Nava one evening, I remember that conversation. I said to Nava, listen, I don't know exactly what's going on, but I think I might've fallen in love with Olga. And she looked at me and she's like, oh, I wondered when you would notice. I was like, okay, then. Oh, okay, it's that clear, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and then Olga and I had a very amusing conversation over the phone because I went home to see my parents who lived in the Frankfurt region in the state of Hesse, where we had originally met. And I called Olga, who was in Berlin at the time, and sort of confessed to her that I thought I had fallen in love with her. And her reply to that was, no, you didn't. And I was like, excuse me? You know, like, who are you to tell me whether I did or did not fall? So anyway, we had this long, I believe it was like a 4 or 5 hour conversation over the phone in which she literally tried to talk me out of being in love because, it, you know, looking back, I understand a bit better why she did that because she just wasn't interested in being my experiment, basically, right? And she said there are, you know, loads of straight women, and as far as she was concerned, I was also straight, and she said that's fine, I'm very happy for people to experiment with their sexuality and their interests, but I don't want to be this test bunny for you, so no, right? And so there was a lot of alignment that was needed initially to even find an agreement around what is the container for us to give this an honest try, while at the same time also acknowledging that I was not quite on the same side of the river as she was, as so to speak, right? So that negotiation took a lot of time in our relationship.
How did you navigate it?
Not very elegantly, I would say, for a long time. I mean, honestly, to this day, I'm sort of amazed that Olga even stayed with me, because the doubts that I had about being in a gay relationship were really profound for me for probably the first 6 years of our relationship. And what I struggled a lot with was realizing how strongly I was influenced by a norm that society had given me without even ever knowing that that norm existed in me. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was not a good discovery, because, as you know, I thought I'm very liberal. I came from a very liberal artsy background. So it wasn't even as if my family or friends had any major issue with me dating Olga. They were surprised. It wasn't what they had expected from me, but nobody made my life hard. Mm-hmm. Who made my life hard was the internalized voice of society that I was holding within me. Mm-hmm. And that was a really, really uncomfortable place for me to be. And I also, the other thing, so firstly, I discovered I had this internalized voice that I wasn't aware of before. And then secondly, I realized that there was something about not having a clear box to fit into anymore that made me very uncomfortable. And that being uncomfortable with, you know, not being fully gay, but also not being fully straight anymore. So suddenly finding myself in this, you know, for the lack of a better terminology at the time, I realized, I guess I'm bisexual, but nobody likes bisexual people, right? For gay people, there's often this air of, well, you're just not out enough yet, mm-hmm. right? And for straight people, or especially men, it's often, well, you know, you haven't had sex with me. Like, if you mm-hmm. would ever have that experience, you wouldn't be so gay anymore. So it felt like I was in this in-between state, and suddenly I was invisible in a way, right? So even looking at how in society, in the media, who is being targeted, right? Who is part of the general narrative? And I know that you have encountered that as well as a gay woman, that only in the last few years have we begun to even be seen in media. Have we become parts of TV shows, movies, advertising, mm-hmm. right? And when I had this moment, this falling in love experience with Olga when I was 28, that wasn't even the case then, right? So the first first really pivotal moment of feeling seen and feeling like there is a place for me in the world in this undefined, fluid persona that I apparently was actually when the first series came out, The L Word. I don't know if you ever mm-hmm. watched that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, to realize that not all lesbians were, checkered shirts and drive on Harleys. Mm-hmm. That for me was a really important moment, because I felt with the way I looked and dressed, I didn't belong. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, that experience was also a very formative experience, because suddenly I realized how important representation is mm-hmm. and how important it is to have a sense of belonging.
So huge. It's so huge to be able to see ourselves represented in the media or like yeah. somewhere else. And like, even today, right now, I know that you're speaking words that people are like, I feel that too. Thank you for sharing that out loud so yeah. that people can not feel so alone.
And it's a humbling experience also, because I think it made me much more receptive to the struggle that people of color go through, and frankly, also especially in Germany, because they're underrepresented just in terms of how many of them even exist in Germany overall. But then realizing that they just simply have not been part of this narrative at all, and why the whole Black Lives Matter movement is so hugely important, because what it is beginning to shift is people's feeling, even internal feeling, that they have a right to be represented, that they have a right to be part of the mainstream storytelling. And I think one of the, you know, bits that we can take away as white people from that, but also that straight people can take away when listening to our conversation now, is how often do you disengage from a narrative because you suddenly don't feel this is about you? Mm-hmm. Right. So I had this conversation recently with Olga. We're both huge film fans, and one of the recent Netflix productions that we really loved was Turning Red, which is an animation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's about this Asian girl who grows up in some nondescript North American town. And it's about her becoming herself, becoming a woman, dealing with her period for the same time, and then this mythical narrative that is connected to becoming a woman. And we absolutely adored this movie. And I cannot tell you how flabbergasted I was at the number of comments by men who basically can't relate. And I'm like, dude, yes, I know, because this is not part of your experience, but, you know, turn on your empathy button and your imagination, because this is a very human story. There's, you know, half of the population of this planet is female, and that's what all of us are going through. So you better make this part of your story as well. Mm-hmm. And I think we've gotten so used to men in particular, but of course also white people, that our stories are being told. And what is now needed is a shift in understanding that these other stories have a place and they're important. And maybe for a time being, they're also more important than the stories of white males, because they've been told over and over again. And then right after that, the stories of white females and mm-hmm. straight people. So now I think is the time to open up storytelling into something that actually represents the richness of life out there. And it can benefit us. So instead of going, oh, this is not my story, I'm not interested, to do the opposite and go, oh, that's fascinating, because that's a story I don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know you do a lot of work helping organizations grow in their consciousness and things. And so I'm curious how this experience of feeling like I'm bi, I don't really fit in either of these camps, how has that now fed into your work and given you in some way some superpowers in helping other people?
I would say that, you know, the sort of at the lowest level, or the you know, the easiest has been for me to have it be part of my public narrative. So from the very beginning, so, you know, even though I really struggled with my own identity and self-definition after I fell in love with Olga, what I've always done from the very beginning was to talk about it. Yeah, so I would run workshops with, you know, what, 25 white males, and I would tell them that I have a girlfriend. And I remember the utter surprise that that elicited in people, because I was, you know, not only did I not confirm to what I thought lesbians are like, but that was the same for everybody else, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I felt it was an educational responsibility that I had to widen mm-hmm. their experience of, well, what is a lesbian woman, right? Mm-hmm. Or what is a woman in a lesbian relationship? Yeah, mm-hmm. maybe that would have been a better description for me, because I never really fully identified as a lesbian, but I would say, well, I'm obviously a woman in a lesbian relationship. I made that life choice. Mm-hmm. So that was a part of it, that I was very upfront with this part of my life, because I felt people just need to know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the same way, for example, Olga is Jewish. And so she often tells people that she is Jewish, because most people have never even consciously met a Jewish person in their life, you know, especially in Germany, because we've done such a, you know, amazing job at eradicating most of them, that there just aren't that many left. Mm-hmm. So for many people, they have this still, you know, very strange picture of what a Jewish person, what a Jew is like, because of generations of narrative that was created and passed on without ever being questioned. And so I think that is one of the things we can do to increase diversity, is to make people more aware of, look at this person, look at that person, look at, you know, look at that person over there, and do listen to their story. And by them telling their story, being invited to tell their story, you begin to expand your understanding of how colorful the world really is. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the first step. And now I'm taking it to a point where, at this moment in time, for my company Conscious You, as you know, because you've participated in one of our programs, CU Money, we have a particular approach to making content scalable, to inviting larger groups of people into an individual experience that is linked with a collective experience. Mm. So we do that in organizations as well. And I'm writing a program right now with a colleague of mine, which is going to be called See You Belong. And the entire program is about creating the ground for a culture of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. Mm. And, you know, and as I'm writing this program, I'm actually constantly thinking, gosh, I'd love to do this program, because I think even though I'm writing it, there's so much more for me to learn. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with inviting people to tell their stories and instructing people who are part of the, you know, the norm, the majority, to increase their sensitivity in getting that story out of people who look different than they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would bet that if you walked into that room with all those guys and said, like, I have a girlfriend, that would set the tone for vulnerability too, that once you start talking in the workshop, it might open the door a little bit for them to.
Yeah, share. No, absolutely. Because I think what it does is it invites. So I've always been a big proponent of saying, let's share our personal stories, even in the work context, because I'm still the same person, right? So mm-hmm. what happens at home influences how I show up here today. And you need to know a little bit of that context to understand where I'm at this mm-hmm. particular day, but also in general in life. So I think we can open the kimono, so to speak, a bit more with each other, right? Mm-hmm. And create cultures where that is not such an outrageous act, but is sort of normal. And the other piece is, you know, just actually the last week, I was writing one of the texts that will go into the See You Belong program. And I was debating for a pretty long time whether I should tell the story or not, but I decided to tell it because I think it opens a door. And the story is about how when I was maybe in year 4 or 5 of my relationship with Olga. And again, you know, still very deeply in my own inner struggle. Will I stay? Do I have to go? Is this the life I want to live? Can I even envision having a family in this kind of setup? You know, all the questions that I had no answers to. And at that point in time, I decided that I needed help and that we needed support as a couple. And I asked a colleague of mine who is an expert in a methodology called voice dialogue, right? It comes from this assumption that instead of thinking there's one consistent version of this entity called Nadia, it might actually be closer to how I experience myself and how other people experience me, to think about there are different versions of Nadia. And they are triggered by different life contexts. They're triggered by whoever I'm standing in front of in this moment in time. They're different, triggered by different stages in my life. And I asked my friend and facilitator, Andrea, to facilitate a voice dialogue session with me with the explicit intention of figuring out who are the different me's or selves that play a role in this relationship that I have with Olga. And what we did at the time is Olga was invited into the space. So she was witnessing this session. And what happened during the session was, so basically in a voice dialogue session, you have a client. The client starts out, you know, on their chair with sort of assumingly all of their selves integrated. And then the facilitator will ask them to tap into their inner experience and go, so what are the voices that you hear in respect to the topic that you chose? So Andrea did that with me. And then the moment you connect to one of these voices or energies within you, the facilitator will actually ask you to physically shift locations in the room. So to find a different position in the room and either stand or sit in that new position. And then the facilitator will talk to this voice as if that voice was its own person. And they will talk to the voice about the client. So in this case, Andrea would talk to this voice about Nadia. Yeah. So Andrea asked me when I was still sitting on my Nadia chair, so, you know, what are the voices that you hear? And then I said, well, I very strongly hear this voice that seems to be very much at the root of all of my doubts and is judgmental about this relationship. And then she said, okay, so, you know, please walk around, find a place in the room and fully connect to that voice. And I did. And actually that took like a split second for that voice to come out with a force that I wasn't expecting. And also a veracity and sort of the degree of judgmentalism that this voice brought to the table was actually quite shocking to me, right? So that voice had a lot to say about my relationship choice, and none of it was good. She was extremely homophobic and, you know, said things like, you know, this is disgusting, this isn't natural, this is not safe, this is not, you know, what shall other people think? I mean, it was just this barrage of homophobic content, basically. And the job of the facilitator, though, is not to change the mind of that voice, but to help that voice to be fully expressed, coming from the assumption whether or not you allow that voice in, it's there anyway. Mm-hmm. But normally it gets censored by other voices who have different opinions about mm-hmm. the same subject matter, right? Mm-hmm. So what voice dialogue in essence does, it gives the floor to a perspective in you and holds that with all the compassion and non-judgment so that that voice can be fully expressed as one perspective in you. So Andrea did a fantastic job and interviewed that voice and, you know, and allowed for all of those thoughts to be expressed. And then at the very end, she asked, and that's also, you know, sort of a very wonderful step, I would say, in the process in general, because you always, as a facilitator, you always ask the voice you're talking to, what is your positive intention? You know, why are you there? And then that voice said, well, you know, Nadia always felt like she didn't fully belong. Like, you know, she was the daughter of immigrants, or at least half of her, her dad was an immigrant. She had this weird last name. She was always very recognizable, always stood out. You know, every time there was sort of a roll calling in the classroom, she was the last one on the list because at that time, as I shared with you before we started, my last name was Zawadzki Krasnopolsky. So it was this endless name starting with a Z. I was always the last one to be called, right? So there are a lot of things that sort of made me feel different. So the voice said, so Nadia always felt different. She didn't feel like she fully belonged. So why in the world would she make this choice to be with Olga when in her case, she doesn't have to make this choice. She could just be with a man. She could just be quote unquote normal. And I'm worried for her. Mm. Right. So then Andrea brought me back. So, and that happens by a bit of a de-rolling process, right? So you thank the voice and then you bring back your original client to their starting position. So I sit back on my chair and suddenly I have this wave of shame, right? Because you know, obviously it's still a metaphor in a way, right? So because that voice is part of me, and I come back to my chair and I realize I just said all of that stuff and Olga listened to all of it. And I was mortified. I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And then Olga was amazing. I mean, she's always amazing, but that was a particularly amazing moment in our relationship because she took my hand and she said, listen, so A, I know you have that voice. And B, don't you think for a moment that I don't have that voice? Of course I have that voice. She's like, there is not a gay person on the planet that doesn't have this voice. Because that's the voice of the internalized collective. That's the voice of society. And we have grown up in a homophobic world. So of course I know this voice. She's like, I'm not afraid of that voice. It's okay to have it because it's part of society. Mm. But the question you need to answer is how much space and how much weight are you giving this opinion in you? Mm-hmm. Because if you allow this part to run our relationship, then we don't stand a chance, right? Because I cannot be with that voice. Mm-hmm. If you have that voice and if you learn how to manage her, I'm okay with that. And I was literally, Nancy, I was mind blown, right? I was like, seriously? So A, you're not mad at me. B, you say you have this voice too. C, you say everybody has this voice. Like, what's going on, right? Mm. It was an incredible moment of becoming, being accepted, including a part of me that I really didn't want to show to the world, because my self-image was not that, mm. right? As a liberal, left-leaning, green-voting, adult human being, I wasn't even supposed to have this voice. Mm-hmm. And to be seen in it and to be received in it and to be accepted with that voice was an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. You know, and then my saving grace was what you often do in voice dialogue work, very similar to what we do when we work with polarities and money work, as you've experienced it, is we always look for the polarity. Right. So assuming that there is this very judgmental, homophobic voice, there's always the assumption, well, there's something else to balance that. Right. So Andrea then looked at what is the other voice there, right? Who else is in there? And then who came out in that second exploration was a part of me that felt much younger, probably like a 16-year-old, and she had the opposite opinion to the first voice and really thought this was the coolest thing I'd ever done in my life, mm-hmm. to be with Olga and to finally have made a choice that fell outside of the norm and what was expected of me. And she was just delighted that I was in this relationship, mm-hmm. and said, you know, honestly, I've never seen you this alive. Nadia has blossomed ever since she met Olga. So I don't know why she would ever leave this woman. This is great. I'm having the time of my life, right? So, and then I was brought back on my chair and sort of realized I have both of these energies or voices or parts, whatever you want to call them. And I'm neither, right? I'm the conductor of this inner orchestra, if I want to use that metaphor. And I can learn how to manage them, and I can learn how to listen to them. And the reason why I wrote down this story for the program that we're going to deliver in organizations is that I want to open the door for people, whether they're straight or white or, you know, whatever other majority they might be part of, to realize if somebody calls you a sexist or calls you racist or calls you homophobic, instead of getting all defensive about it, to say, you know what, chances are you're probably right. But it may not be anything personal, because it may be something that comes from society. That doesn't mean because it comes from society, it isn't real. But I can look at this and I can engage with this part of me and I can learn to understand what function it serves, and I can learn to manage it, and I can learn that I have this and I'm still lovable, and that I can be really stupid when I allow this part to take over and very hurtful to other people, and that there are more creative ways of being in the world than just being overtaken by that part that was formed by a very narrow-minded society, that I have many more colors even within me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that's sort of, you know, leveling up my contribution to organizations, I would say.
Because mm-hmm. if someone like you can have this homophobic personality within you, then we all can have something.
Exactly, right? And to not be so fucking scared of it anymore and mm-hmm. go, okay, that's probably the case. So what are we going to do with that? Mm-hmm. Right? And the core message of that module then in See You Belong is really going to be, firstly, don't be so afraid of exploring the parts of you that you may not even necessarily like yourself. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I do think, especially as somebody who considers yourself to be a liberal person, we need to look at this stuff, because otherwise, if we shut that voice down constantly because it's not PC, what we're risking is that the only place where we can be received and with that voice is sort of the right-wing spectrum, because they don't have an issue with it, right? There you can just let it all hang out and they will applaud you for it. But in sort of the left, more liberal circles, we'll have to find a way to articulate that and not shut each other down while at the same time also recognizing there's of course a time and a place to do this. So, you know, it may not be the appropriate choice to sort of voice all of my homophobic and racist content and you know, in front of a Black gay person, because they don't need to know that. They have enough of that stuff all the mm-hmm. time anyway. But I may have appropriate circles where I can talk about what is moved within me when I encounter something that is different from me, mm-hmm. that makes me feel strange, that makes me feel insecure, maybe that even frightens me. Yeah. So to create spaces where these conversations can take place, and then to figure out, so what do I need to learn to handle this in a different way? And also to learn, just because I feel like that doesn't mean I have the right to make structural or political decisions that are based on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can be uncomfortable, for example, or even feel disgusted by gay sex. I don't think that's an issue. If you're a straight person, frankly, you don't have to have gay sex. So be my guest. You can be as uncomfortable as you want to. However, does that give you the right to limit gay people's choice in how they live their relationships and whether they want to get married or not, or whether they want to have children or not? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it does.
Yeah. And it sounds very similar to the process of reclamation that, you know, I've been learning, and I love how you integrate it into your conscious you money. And so tell me how learning that process has also influenced your life and in practice.
Yeah, so the you know, the idea with the reclamations is, and you've heard me talk about this in CU Money, I always look for what is the jack in the box that you have collected along the path of your development. So what is a topic that requires a lot of energy from you to stay hidden, right? Mm-hmm. Because I always picture these jack in the boxes, and we usually, unfortunately, also have more than one, which makes life so hard, because that mm-hmm. means you have topics that you are trying to keep in the box, but the box actually requires a lot of energy on your part to stay shut, because it wants to come out and you don't want it to come out. So for example, going back to my previous story, my jack in the box at the time was my homophobic side, because I didn't want to be that. And I also did not want anybody to see that, because I was not proud of it. Yeah. But then a lot of energy goes into suppressing that stupid lid from coming open. And what we do in reclamation work is we open the box and we go, okay, we have this box anyway. There's this weird thing inside. Let's look at it. Right. And then once we looked at it, we can even begin to make peace with it. We can even begin to fall in love with that part and begin to realize that in every energy, including the ones that we don't like, including the parts of us that we don't like, there is a hidden gem, right? So to realize in my story that my homophobic part was actually looking out for me, was trying to protect me from the discomfort of feeling that I didn't belong, made me make my peace with it, right? And so the reclamation is really about, what am I hiding, not just from other people, but also from myself, that needs to be integrated fully into my identity, into how I describe myself. So I believe to end sexism, to end racism, to end, you know, all the structural inequalities that so many on this planet struggle with, what we actually need to do is we first need to acknowledge that we are all of these things, and to find what is the good even in that. And then to see, what else am I? So that brings us then to the polarity, because, you know, as I discovered in my voice dialogue session, I do have this inner homophobic part, and I have the delighted 16-year-old who thinks being with Olga is the best thing that ever happened in my life, right? Mm-hmm. And I have both of them. So to become more whole, that was what the projection work has given me, is a permission to fall in love with myself, warts and all. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, what I now transport in all the programs that I run, whether it's CU Money or CUI, or in the future CU Belong. For me, that's really the mission, is that we don't just acknowledge that we are human beings who are fallible, but that we begin to be fully okay with that and like those things about ourselves and be kind, have self-compassion. And I think that's the root then of true compassion and true empathy with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, you know, exactly that concept is what has led me to create these block parties. Because I see that, you know, we all have these places where we feel blocked and we're stuck. We keep bumping up against something that we don't want to acknowledge or have there. And then if we can come into a space where someone can hold that with us, explore it with us, and then embrace it.
And laugh about it.
Embrace the polarity. And then it actually does end up in this party of like celebrating this amazing gift in the block. And so it's been fun to help people.
No, I think it's also a wonderful way to reattribute the term block party. I think that's a wonderful term that you've chosen.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here today. It was so awesome to hear your journey. And I really appreciate the ways that you've been so honest and vulnerable with us. And I know that there's going to be so many people listening that are going to be like, I feel that too. Thank you for speaking that out loud so that I don't feel so alone in it.
It was my joy and my pleasure. And as I said before, I think representation, you know, seeing that I'm not the only weird person out there, or the only different person out there,
the outliers,
right? To realize, you know, yes, you're special, but also you're not that special, because there are other people like you out there, and they come in all shapes and sizes and colors and genders and orientations and all of it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of life is to, well, yeah, maybe that's sort of the final point for me is to embrace diversity in the external world requires that we embrace the diversity in our internal world. First. And if we can do that through also gifts like the one you're bringing to the world with your podcast and the block party, then I think we can be a different humanity.
Mm-hmm. It's all possible.
Yes. Thank you for having me, Nancy.
Yeah, and thank you for being a contributor of creating that better world.
If you're wondering what this block party is that Nadia is talking about in our interview, it's a little thing that I've created where I help people come and move from a block that they're feeling in their life to a party. And so when you feel that you're bumping up against something and you just can't get over that mental barrier, or you just keep ruminating on the same frustration, someone's really getting under your skin, or you're disappointed with yourself in some way, come. Set up a session with me for a block party. You can find it on my website, centered.ca. And you can have either your own block party, where we'll move through that block to feeling free and where you can find the gift in that block. And so it's a party. Or we could do it in a group. I've come into organizations and led block parties where multiple people are sitting there listening, and maybe I'm working with one person, but usually the block is something quite universal. And so it's a way to help one person, but everyone can be following along and helping themselves in the process. And it can be a really unifying experience, because sometimes whoever's in the hot seat can't express what it is that they're feeling until someone else shares what was coming up for them. And then it reflects back to them, and it's a breakthrough, and just all around really powerful process to use some of these tools that Nadia was talking about in our conversation to help create more freedom and more expansiveness for us. So reach out, let me know if you'd like a block party. And then the other thing that Nadia was talking about is Conscious You. And this is an organization that she's created that is an amazing place to learn, particularly about money. She has a course, See You Money, coming up starting in March, and I can't recommend it enough. If you have any kind of struggle with money, about not having enough of it or getting it and then feeling overwhelmed by how much you have or what to do with it, or feeling like it's dirty, or feeling like you just wish you had some, this is the perfect place to go to work through that stuff and to find what it is that is going on within you around money. And often it's a mirror to other stuff that's going on for us. So I'll put the link in the show notes for Nadia and See You Money, but I fully recommend that you should sign up. I did it last year and it was amazing. And I'm really seeing results in my life in regards to money ever since then. So I can't wait to hear what happens if you take her up on that course. Okay, we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Coming Out Chronicles. If you enjoyed it and you think it would be helpful for someone else, please share it with them. If you'd like to connect with me, reach out on social. I'd love to support you in the next chapter of your coming out story. I can help you know yourself, free yourself, and be yourself. Until next time, this is Nancy Shadlock from Centered Life Coaching.